again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
Let me say this. Ron Maynard has started this, and he may not be the only one who's doing this, but you know what? I think it's a pretty good place to start the offensive.
Coming up, we'll join a July 4th block party protest outside the House of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
Nobody would state outright that they were opposed to it other than the National Association of Broadcasters and to a kind of a lesser degree, NPR. And over time, it became kind of politically awkward for them to be opposed to something that they claimed they weren't threatened by.
And we'll hear about an upcoming opportunity to expand community radio in Chicago and nationwide. But first, here are some headlines from the Indie Media Network around the world. Indie Media UK and Indie Media Ireland posted features on protests and events connected with the 2013 G8 conference held in mid-June at the Golf Resort in Enniskillen in Northern Ireland. Indie Media Ireland noted that the local police have been taking great pride in telling international media reporters about the hundreds of prison cells they have available for G8 protesters, and that, as an added precaution, they are going to reopen closed British Army bases for the occasion. To make sure they even have more prison space, the G8 has moved from Great Britain to Ireland to avoid a repeat of widespread summer riots in England 2011. Indie Media UK noted a variety of protest actions in London, convened by the Stop G8 Committee, including a carnival against capitalism in both Oxford Circus and Piccadilly Circus, a rally entitled "They Owe Us, Shift the Debt" in Canary Wharf, and a solidarity benefit night featuring international music. IndieBay reported on a settlement between Occupy Oakland activists and the Oakland, California Police Department. Quoting from the feature dated July 6th, 12 people injured by the Oakland Police Department during Occupy Oakland demonstrations have settled a federal civil rights lawsuit with the City of Oakland for a total of $1.17 million. The physical injuries came as a result of OPD's violent response to Occupy Oakland on October 25th and November 2nd, 2011. Plaintiffs to receive compensation for injuries include David Morse, a longtime member of the San Francisco Bay Area Independent Media Center. The settlement in the case comes on the heels of another $1 million settlement still pending final approval. As a result of both cases, OPD has agreed to allow the federal court to enforce OPD's compliance with its own crowd control policy and to negotiate with the National Lawyers Guild and the American Civil Liberties Union before making any changes to the policy. The control policy prohibits police from shooting less lethal impact munitions or tossing explosive tear gas grenades into crowds and prohibits mass arrests without warning or opportunity to disperse. DC Indie Media featured a protest and an unusually aggressive police response over the revelations of electronic domestic surveillance. Quoting from the feature, on the 14th of June, area activists stage a protest near Upper Senate Park against the NSA's PRISM spy program, against the general public, and in solidarity with NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Capitol Police were unusually aggressive about trying to intimidate the protesters into silence. First, police harassed videographers from the international media for using tripods. Next, they issued two warnings that the protesters on the street corner were protesting without a permit. They did this even though actual arrests would expose them to a judgment from the same federal courts that forced payouts to Becker and Pershing Park settlements. In response to the threats, protesters moved to the center of Upper Center Park only to be told the second warning was still valid. Fed up, organizers called the police on their bluff, continuing the rally. After a Texas state representative spoke out against drones and federal surveillance and terror at home and abroad, the police threats vanished. Pittsburgh Indie Media has announced the suspension of new episodes of its regular radio program after a 9-year run, quoting from a statement published on July 15th. In May of 2004, Rust Belt Radio was initiated as a new project of the Pittsburgh IMC. Inspired by programs such as Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News, Rust Belt Radio was created as a one-hour biweekly show of news from the grassroots, news overlooked by corporate media. At this point of low volunteer capacity, we have decided to take a break from creating new shows in order to reflect on the future of the project, its role in the community, and the independent alternative media landscape in the Pittsburgh area. We are seeking community input and feedback, as we have always envisioned this project as a community-led, participatory project that builds and supports movements for social justice in Pittsburgh and beyond. Please note that we will not be creating any new episodes of Rust Belt Radio until further notice. Past episodes are available on radio.indypgh.org. Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indymedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
O come, Emmanuel, and pay homage to Blue Dog Democrats, who serve the corporations with glee, and fill the party coffers with booty. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel, the change promised our nation is unreal. O come ye protector Emmanuel, ye friend of health insurance companies, who profit by denying coverage to sick and dying patients doubly screwed. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel, healthcare reform is compromised away.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has angered a lot of Chicagoans due to his harsh policies on everything from closing mental health clinics, Chicago public schools, and giving away vast sums to politically connected cronies. His policies have also unified a lot of previously disconnected efforts, some of who gathered on July 4, 2013, to hold a march and block party outside of his house on Chicago's north side. We'll now hear from some of the participants of the July 4th block party, who spoke at a press conference outside of Rahm Emanuel's house.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Donnelly, and I'm representing CoFA, Communities United Against Foreclosure and Eviction. We're here in front of Rahm Emanuel's house. I'm quite sure he's safe and secure. Right now, myself and my girlfriend are homeless. We have been victimized through these harsh and severe cuts that have been given to government programs. She lost her voucher back in February. We got a voucher cut back in February, so we were left homeless without any recourse with two minor children. So we decided to occupy. So we identified a bank-owned house in Rogers Park, and we moved in, and we got volunteers to help clean out the place. Had a little bit of water damage, and we made it livable. We invested over $1,000, about $1,500 in that, and we held that house for like 60 days. Unfortunately, we were forced out through a judicial auction. The company that bought it is one of the largest global players in real estate, Blackstone Group. They came in, locked us out. They forcibly detained us, and we were jailed on trespassing charges. Not once, but twice. Yeah, I know I said twice. We went back. But anyway, we're just here to just let people know that we understand that the foreclosure crisis from the south side to the south to the north side to the west side. I grew up in public housing. The CHA plan for transformation is really like a plan for termination. And, you know, there's so much that could have been done and should be done in this crisis. And we know that it all connects to the loss of schools and gang warfare, all the killings, because people are just being forced into a corner. All the poor middle class is being pushed down. And I'm just here to just represent and just say that we're standing up. Rahm Emanuel, one-term mayor.
austerity budget will make the school virtually inoperable. No money for basic supplies like soap and toilet paper in the bathrooms. The austerity budget means the loss of around 40 jobs in our building, from teachers to office staff to security guards. I'm also a parent of a public school student. My daughter's school will lose more than $1 million next year. Once again, jobs lost, educational programs unsustainable. The story is repeated in hundreds of schools across the city, and we're the lucky ones because my daughter still has a school to attend next year, and I still have a job waiting for me at the end of the summer. When our unelected school board voted to close an unprecedented number of schools from the most disenfranchised neighborhoods in the city, they claimed a need for austerity. We simply can't afford these underutilized schools. When they slashed budgets across the district, they claimed it was unavoidable because of the severe budget deficit, and then pointed the finger at teacher pensions. The mayor and the school board actually want us to buy into the idea that the city is so financially insecure that the only solution is to make city workers and children pay. So here's the thing about austerity and education. It doesn't save money, and it doesn't improve education. But that doesn't mean that it's not working. In fact, Chicago's program of austerity and education is part of a nationwide trend. Discussions of budget deficit is just a distraction. These are the real five pillars of corporate education reform. One, you replace learning with testing. And then you move to two, you punish and destabilize public schools. That leads to three, weakening unions. Four, privatizing educations. And then the final pillar, you make billions of dollars in profit off the backs of our children. Chicago poet Malcolm London summed it up beautifully in his poem Training Ground. He wrote, "I hear the education systems are failing, but I believe they are succeeding at what they're built to do."
All right.
At the Board of Ed meeting on June 26th, parent Victoria Grippo-Benson spoke about the cost of austerity at her child's school, and she finished by telling the board, "I don't buy what you're selling, nor do I have trust in this system that's supposedly all about the children." And in this era of austerity, none of us can afford to buy into a public school system that Chicago's trying to sell us. That's why we have a moral responsibility to keep fighting until we have taken back the power and regained control of our communities, our schools, and our children's futures.
Hello, happy Independence Day. My name is Katie Osgood, and I am a teacher.
Yeah.
I teach at a psychiatric hospital here in the city, and I work with students from all over Chicagoland and of all ages, including hundreds of CPS students. And in my hospital, I have seen directly the impact of Rahm Emanuel's terrible school policies. We are seeing higher rates of depression, suicide attempts, school refusal, family conflict, anxiety, and aggressive behaviors that are all directly related to the current school policies in this city. To put it bluntly, CPS and this mayor's policies are hurting children. When you viciously close schools, when you slash their budgets, including taking money for social workers, smaller classes, arts, music, gym, when you fire the trusted teachers and staff, all these things hurt kids. In the middle of all this, our mayor has the gall to cut mental health services and to close mental health facilities. But you see, the chaos of our system is intentional. The people in charge call it creative disruption. It's a business term. They want to let market forces determine where schools will stand.
Boo!
They might make a buck or two in the process, right, Juan Rangel of Uno Charter Schools?
Boo!
You could throw up a charter here, close down a school there, and heck, we'll even close down the underperforming charters. Gee, thanks. They treat schools like shoe stores in a strip mall. They're not like historic institutions that are grounding communities. I have met countless children who are lost in this madness. They're going to 3, 4, 5 different schools in as many years. Here's the pattern I keep seeing. Students start a neighborhood school, the school is closed, or the parents are lured to a charter. The charter very quickly pushes out that student due to behavior problems or disabilities. And I am hearing absolutely frightening stories coming from my kids from the charter schools. Absolutely terrifying. And then that child bounces back to yet another neighborhood school, which may or may not be closed. Kids learn to hate school, to fear it, and under this system, children become liabilities. They're simply bad assets that need to be dumped when they are not deemed profitable. You know what? Kids know it when they're not wanted.
Yes! Yeah. Yes!
They're human.
And it's heartbreaking to watch these kids be beaten down by school reform. This is madness.
Yes.
Children need stability. They need connection. They need strong ties to their neighborhood schools and communities. They need schools that are funded to work and be successful. Yeah. Our kids need fully certified, experienced teachers. As our district lays off experienced teachers, did you know that they have just expanded the contract with Teach for America?
No.
Tripling their budget and bringing in almost 100 more uncertified novices that have never taught a day in their life.
Whoa.
And these policies are most damaging to our students with special needs, who are the most deeply impacted by the bad policy coming from 125 Clark Street and our 1% mayor.
All right.
Yeah.
Mayor Emanuel is deliberately enforcing policies that hurt children. We have a name for people who deliberately hurt children.
Abusers.
Sociopaths.
I've seen my CPS students and colleagues in the schools become weary and be beaten down with exhaustion and demoralization. The longest school day, coupled with the longest school closings process ever, was impossibly tiring. Hearing after hearing and bad news on bad news, crazy budget cuts on top of everything else. But Rom and the other bullies at CPS want this. They want to wear us out. They want to beat us down. They want to keep us too tired to speak up. But will they succeed?
No!
No, because what they will never understand is that we are fighting for flesh and blood children. We know these kids by name. They are our children. These are our precious sons and daughters, our students, who fill up our schools in our communities.
That's right.
Whose schools?
Our schools.
Whose communities?
Our communities.
Whose children?
Our children.
I wish we could say that it was just Rom and his twisted mind, but it's not. This is part of a larger attack happening all over the country against teachers, against schools, on low-income communities of color, on public education, on public services.
You hear that, Barack?
But let me say this. Rom may not have started this, and he may not be the only one who's doing this, but you know what? I think he's a pretty good place to start the offensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's time to take back our city. Take back our schools. And let's make Rom be a one-term mayor.
The recent reform, the Affordable Health Care Act,
will in fact guarantee that the healthcare corporations, and that is the insurance corporations, will continue to make millions, billions in profit. They'll be able to profit on it because now we're going to be mandated to purchase an insurance policy, but it does not necessarily mean that you will have access to actual health care. Furthermore, under the plan, the Affordable Health Care Act, the idea was that people were supposed to be covered, but in reality, more than 30 million people will remain uninsured. The other thing that's even more egregious is that all of those folks who are undocumented, all of our brothers and sisters who are part of our class, will not have access to this Affordable Health Care Act, either through purchasing it on the exchanges or in the expansion of Medicare. They are 100% excluded. This is absolutely egregious. So this is why the National Nurses United and many of the folks who are probably out here that we have been fighting for what's called a single-payer health care for all.
Woo! Medicare for all!
Essentially, Medicare for all.
Medicare
and
for all.
And in fact, if we look to our neighbors to the north, even though their system is under attack, the reality is that Canadians are a lot better off economically than we are, and they in fact have a single-payer health care system as such. And across the globe, we are all facing austerity, let's make no mistake, but the reality is that we would be a lot better off if we would have access to health care. I think that the other thing that I want to say about the healthcare system and what the proposals are in the Affordable Healthcare, I don't want to talk about it too much, but the thing that's really sort of galling about it is that those folks who do have healthcare insurance plans, currently purchase those, are going to be facing some pretty egregious, I call it penalties. So for those who have jobs and you have a fairly decent healthcare plan, you're going to be looking at a 40% excise tax to that employer. And so who do you think the employer is going to pass that cost along to? It'll get passed along to us. And so there are all kinds of, you know, we're looking at the South, we're looking across the country, many groups of people are going to be left out of this so-called reform. So for those of us who are gathered here today, I want to say that we have to continue this fight. And I am being sober for a reason. I mean, we have our children. We have our grandchildren. We have the schools that are closing. And we have so many things that we're fighting against. But I say that we have to fight towards something. And the reality is that if we don't figure out what we're fighting toward, we will constantly be in a position of fighting against. Yep. So what I'm fighting toward, I feel like I'm fighting towards some things that are going to get us in a position to get further down the road. We got to fight for single payer.
Woo!
We got to fight for a single payer healthcare system for all.
Woo!
We also have a proposal with respect to, it's called the Robin Hood tax. It's about charging the very wealthy, that is those people who trade on the stock market, you know, billions and millions and millions of transactions a second, that every last single one of those transactions should be charged and that they should be made to pay because they were the ones who created this crisis in the first place.
Yes!
And that financial transaction tax is gaining ground in Europe, putting a little bit of pressure on the administration here, but the reality is that it changes the debate across the country and across the world, that those who created this crisis, you're the ones that need to pay. So we're kind of like the modern-day Robin Hoods of sort. We say to you, time is up for you to now be in control of everything that has to do with our lives. We're going to come. We're going to take back our streets. We're going to take back our schools.
Woo!
We're going to take back our cities.
Woo!
We're going to take back our country.
Woo!
We declare ourselves independent on this day, the 4th of July, 2013. We declare our independence. We declare our independence from the banks. We declare our independence from austerity.
Ow!
We declare our independence from suffering. We declare our independence from homelessness. How dare there be a homeless person in this country when we have, I don't know how many millions of vacant buildings. When we have food piling up in caves across the country. How dare we have people that be without when we have so much prosperity. How dare they confront us with austerity when there is so much for everyone. So I say to you, let's declare independence. Happy 4th of July to the working class people of this city, to the working class people of the state, and to the working class people of this country, and I dare say, the world.
The city made the decision to close 6 public mental health clinics, as all of you know.
Like this one?
At the same time, they fired the only 3 black male therapists that we had.
The city,
an even greater challenge is that as black men are coming home from prison, they are told they have to see as a requirement for them to be released, a therapist. who are they going to see? Since the city has closed those public mental health clinics, three of their private partners have gone out of business. So what we have now is mayhem. We've had an increase of deaths. We've had more suicides. Last year, we were fortunate enough due to this mayor to have more than 500 deaths because of murders. I got a tax bill 2 days ago. It was $1,400. I saw where I'm paying for schools. All the schools in my neighborhood are being closed.
Boo!
I'm paying for public health clinics. All of them are being closed.
Boo!
What the mental health movement is doing today is we started educating people around the city about mental health. Schizophrenia, depression, things that are affecting people's lives every day.
PTSD.
And absolutely, PTSD. We did a PTSD for adults and PTSD for children, and we're about to do those two workshops again in other communities. So you can feel free to contact us to find out where those workshops are going to be. But more than that, Chicago needs to heal. So the mental health movement is starting a Heal Chicago Committee. Heal Chicago campaign. And that says that people have the right to heal. They have a right to resources. And resources means public schools, public hospitals, public health care, public housing.
Woo.
It is something that we all pay for.
Yeah.
I'm passing around literature. I hope everyone will take some of it. Because what we need to do is form an army and get rid of not just the mayor, but all 50 of his little pimp children.
That voted
to close the clinics, making sure the schools are closed, in addition to which the water is now privatized, which means all of the people that are taking 10 medications a day, and there's quite a few of us, they will be under the scrutiny of whoever private partner there is. And if your water is cut off, you could die with all that medication in your body. We need a government that is going to do what we need.
Woo!
Please form your Heal Chicago committees so we can all get rid of the aldermen, get rid of the mayor, get rid of the governor, replace these people who are not for us and not with us. We cannot afford a mayor who only believes that the wealthy have a reason to live.
You've been listening to participants of the July 4th Block Party against Rahm Emanuel's policies. We're coming to you from the trenches. The Federal Communications Commission will open up a window for applicants to low-power FM radio stations in cities around the country. While few people know about this window, fewer people know about the behind-the-scenes struggle of how that opportunity came to be. It's a story of struggle by independent activists against some of the most powerful lobbyists in Washington. We'll learn about the radio window, how it happened, and issues related to the opportunity, including how it can affect Chicago, in this interview with Sean Campbell of the Chicago Independent Radio Project, who spoke with Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Stefanchik on Friday, July 19th, 2013.
We are joined on the phone with Sean Campbell. Sean is the founder and general manager of Chirp Radio, the Chicago Independent Radio Project. Sean, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
for the benefit of listeners who may be unfamiliar with CHIRP, tell us a little bit, in about a minute or so, what it is and why you founded it.
Sure. CHIRP is an independent radio station that really focuses on music, arts, and culture here in Chicago. So we play a ton of independent music and local music, and we are staffed by 200 volunteers. And the whole reason that I started CHIRP was because I felt like there was a real lack of independent voices in terms of what was going on in Chicago's creative communities. And there's so much great music in the city. There are so many people who are doing really interesting creative work that I wanted to make sure that there was a showcase for that. There was also a real hunger that I was hearing from people who were potential listeners of the station. So I had a great group of volunteers who were interested in making a really cool independent radio station and a lot of people who wanted to listen to it. And so we launched the organization back in 2007, spent a couple years raising money, raising awareness, and launched the station itself in January of 2010.
But the station currently is internet only, is that correct?
We're online at chirpradio.org, yes.
I mentioned that because there's an opportunity that is coming up for the expansion of radio frequencies or the availability of radio frequencies across the United States, what's called low-power FM. For the benefit of listeners who may be unfamiliar with that, could you please explain?
Sure. Low-power FM is, to put really simply, it's they're 100-watt radio stations that are licensed to nonprofit organizations, which can be independent community groups, schools, churches, neighborhood associations, and the low-power FM service was created in 2000 and definitely was intended as something of an answer to the rampant commercialization and deregulation of ownership that had just racked commercial radio over the past couple of decades. And so when the service was created in 2000, it was great that these stations were available, but unfortunately the way the law was written was that applicants in the 50 largest markets in the country weren't eligible to apply because they said there just wasn't space on the dial. There had to be three clicks between every station on the dial at that point. So a new law was put forward almost immediately that would open up the dial in big cities like Chicago, and we worked on that bill for nearly 10 years before it was finally passed, and President Obama signed that into law in late 2010. And so then it went to the FCC to write new rules for how applicants in big cities would be able to apply and what that process would be like. They've just released their rules this year. There's going to be an application window in October, and there actually are opportunities in most big cities for at least a couple new stations, which is really exciting.
What really interests me about this is not just the fact that this is happening, which is, of course, exciting in and of its own right. It's a rare opportunity for gaining radio stations. But also the fact that we could talk about the story about how this legislation got passed. It was apparently not something that happens overnight. In fact, very few people I found not only know that there's this opportunity coming, but even fewer know about the kind of insider politics of what happened with this law that's called the Local Community Radio Act. I'd like you to discuss, if you could please, a bit about the story about how the Local Community Radio Act came to be. There were some pretty powerful interests that wanted to prevent the law from coming into play, weren't there?
Sure. Anytime there's an opportunity to add new broadcasters to the dial, the entrenched interests are always going to oppose it, because as much as organizations like the National Association of Broadcasters, which represents commercial broadcast interests, is a really powerful lobby in Washington, as much as they may say, like, oh, little 100-watt community radio stations, we don't feel threatened by them. You know, they're not a threat to our big 50,000-watt broadcasters. The fact is they're very much a threat. Even though about 97% of all Americans still listen to radio at some point every single week, the way that they utilize radio and the amount of time that they listen to radio has changed and decreased. And a big part of the reason for that is because I always say, you know, people didn't leave radio, radio left people. And so people are really unhappy, by and large, with the fact that there are, you know, up to 15 minutes of commercials every hour on their local community, or on their local commercial radio station. You know, they're unhappy about the fact that there's no variety and that it's the same songs over and over again, that it's the same voices on the air that they hear all the time, and that a lot of radio, which used to have as its strength the fact that it was live and it was immediate, it was right there in your community, a lot of local, and I'm making little finger quotes around local, a lot of local radio is no longer local. It's syndicated programming, it's hosts who are on the air and 17 different markets at the same time. It's voice tracking where the hosts that you're hearing actually have pre-recorded their breaks ahead of time, and there's just a computer dropping those audio pieces in between songs. And so people aren't very happy with commercial radio. And so when the low-power FM service was first being debated, the National Association of Broadcasters and, unfortunately, also NPR were really opposed to it and worked pretty hard to keep news stations out of big cities. They also fought to defend what are called translators, which allow stations to further their broadcast range by owning other transmitters in far-flung places, and they can actually retransmit their signal. And you're supposed to use translators to basically help you if the terrain is weird. So if you, you know, are in a mountainous region, you can have a translator down in a valley to make sure your signal gets there. But what a lot of interests were doing is buying up tons of translators and effectively creating nationwide networks with the same programming by bouncing their signal across the country from translator to translator. A lot of religious broadcasters have done this. And so, you know, once the Local Community Radio Act was being debated, the issue of translators definitely played a prominent role, because translators often sit in the same places on the dial that could be used by low-power FMs. And, of course, the difference is low-power FM stations would be creating local content that was specific to that community, whereas a translator is just retransmitting a distant signal. So there was a real fight. Like I say, the NAB is a hugely powerful lobby, and the Local Community Radio Act came up a number of times and sat and didn't pass. And it really took a great deal of work by a really interesting coalition of grassroots groups. At a time when there is very little bipartisanship, obviously, in Washington, the fight for the Local Community Radio Act was a truly bipartisan fight. And the reason for that is because everybody believes that their voice isn't well represented on the air. You know, the far, far right believes that as much as the far left believes that. And so when we would go to lobby on the bill in D.C., we would be joined, you know, there would be a lot of very progressive organizations, but we'd also be joined by, you know, groups who were, I remember one particular group who was from Georgia, and when they stood up and introduced themselves, they said, you know, we want to create a station to help stop killing all those babies. Like, their whole premise was anti-abortion. And so you find yourself in with very strange bedfellows sometimes. But, you know, in the interest of trying to expand community radio, you know, those groups work together. And like Joe Wilson, the guy who yelled, "You lie," on the...
Right.
On the House floor, at Obama.
During the State of the Union address.
Yeah, he was a co-sponsor of this bill. He was a big supporter of this bill, you know, as on the other side, you know, were great progressive legislators like Maria Cantwell in Washington, for instance, you know, who's been a proponent of the bill from the beginning. She's one of the original co-sponsors of the bill on the Senate side. So it really brought together an interesting group of people, and eventually, those, you know, the grassroots groups doing a lot of lobbying, working with national organizations like Prometheus Radio Project and the Future of Music Coalition and Free Press, it just came to a point where it kind of couldn't be denied anymore. Nobody would state outright that they were opposed to it, other than the National Association of Broadcasters and, to a kind of a lesser degree, NPR. And over time, it became kind of politically awkward for them to be opposed to something that they claimed they weren't threatened by. And so the bill did eventually pass in 2010, but it definitely took a lot of jockeying.
But at least it is inspiring. You can actually show that even intimidating, powerful, well-heeled, well-funded interests that are that say they're for the public but act against it can be defeated.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a really good message. And, you know, the message is also that it takes some time often, and you can't give up. You can't have one defeat in one legislative session and just be like, well, I guess that's it. I guess it's not going to work. I mean, this fight went on for almost 10 years, and eventually it was successful. I think that's a lesson that actually people on the right are very much more comfortable with sometimes than people on the left. You know, you have to be in it for the long term, and we were in it for the long term, and we've seen some success with it now.
So now with the law passed and the Federal Communications Commission has awarded or soon will make available a window for various people to apply for available spectrum. And so this leads to a number of questions. First, I'd like to ask is that in cities like Chicago, where there are already a lot of radio stations, spectrum might not be available. And so I'd like to ask you, if, say, I were to start a radio station, I say I'm going to go ahead and do this, and I get all my friends, and we do what we need to do to make an application. Is there spectrum available in Chicago or in some of the big cities? And if so, how much?
It's not 100% clear right now because there are certain things that can happen. Right now, the speculation is that there could be 4 new licenses for Chicago. There are also some issues based on where those stations might be located, where those applicants might be located, because Chicago is such a big city, and 100 watts is low power. It's right there in the name. That you could feasibly potentially have co-channel stations on the same number on the dial at two opposite ends of the city. That wouldn't interfere with each other at all. Till the applications are filed, it's hard to say. You know, as we look at things, like I say, there are a few requirements that you have to have in place. You have to be an established nonprofit that's been operating for 3 years, I believe it is. So, you know, you can't just be some guy on the street who wants to have a radio station and submit an application. So you have to be, it has to be a nonprofit that's submitting the application. And you do have to make some demonstrations that you are going to provide local programming, that you're not just going to be a jukebox, you're not going to be automating all your programming, you're not going to be just rebroadcasting existing programming from another source. So the application itself is really simple. It was created to have a low barrier to entry. They didn't want low-power FMs to be limited to people who only to people who had a ton of, you know, engineering expertise and a lot of resources to be able to hire the best engineers. They wanted it to be a simple application that people could largely fill out themselves. Because Chicago is a congested market on the dial, they most likely you will be requesting waivers, which makes the application a little more complicated, and you probably do need to work with a broadcast engineer on that. You know, it's not a matter of spending tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to have an engineering study done. And there are also, like I say, groups like Prometheus Radio Project, for instance, that are providing help to a lot of low-power FM hopefuls around the country. But Chicago is an interesting case. We're actually better off than New York or L.A., in looking at the, you know, potentially maybe 4 new stations. And it's just also interesting because, you know, unlike New York City, for instance, we are pretty sprawling. And so that actually opens up some additional opportunities that might not be there for a city that's a very small and tightly congested in, you know, over just a couple of miles.
I would take it that, and I think this is actually listed on the Chirp Radio website, Chirp Radio is or would plan to file for an application during this window in October. Is that correct?
Yes.
If it turns out that Chirp happens to win a license, will this change how Chirp operates? And if so, could you explain a little bit how?
No, the funny thing is, or you know, the interesting thing is, from the beginning, from the time that we launched the station, in January of 2010, we always had our eye on this because we'd been working on the low-power FM issue. And so when we set up the station, we set it up to basically mimic a broadcast station in its operations. And so we wanted to be prepared and not have to change things if we did eventually get a broadcast license, because it's a lot easier to teach people to do things one way than to let them do things, you know, one way for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years, and then after they've been doing it that way for all those years, tell them, okay, now you have to change what you're doing and do things a completely different way. So we operate as a broadcast station right now. We're just a broadcast station that doesn't happen to have a broadcast license. So, you know, other than just building a tower and, you know, getting a transmitter and getting a set of call letters, we don't anticipate there being much change at all.
Suppose, again, Chirp wins a radio license. How long would it be between this window and October that a license would be had, just assuming that a license was forthcoming?
Well, the thing is, we don't know how long it's going to take the FCC to evaluate the applications. Our national partners speculate that there could be as many as 10,000 new applications across the country this October. And the first thing that the FCC will do is they'll evaluate all of what they call the singletons. And those are applicants that don't have any competition to them. So those will be the stations out in, you know, in rural Idaho and Nebraska and perhaps downstate Illinois, all the places where likely there aren't going to be competing applications.
And so it would be one applicant, there happens to be spectrum available, nobody else wants it, voila, here it is for you.
More or less, you know, as long as they're, you know, they have to show that they have a location, that it's legal, that they, you know. But yes, more, you know, it's not completely a rubber stamp, but it's definitely a quicker process. Mm. Like, okay, this application looks good, everything's legally in line, good, on to the next one. So that, you know, that process should go relatively quickly, but we don't know how many applications there will be that will fall into that category. Then you get into the category of what are called mutually exclusive applicants. And those are applicants who are applying for the same frequencies. This will definitely be the case in your bigger cities where there are likely to be multiple applicants. And in that case, the FCC is going to have to take a closer look at those applications. There's a point system that's awarded based on a number of things, some that I mentioned earlier. Like the fact that you say that you will create at least 8 hours of local programming every day, that your board is 85% local, I believe is the number, that you'll have a staffed facility at least some portion of the week rather than, again, operating on automation. Unfortunately, back in 2000 when they did the first window and there were a lot of applicants, a lot of those low-power FMs, particularly those licensed to churches, did end up kind of operating almost purely on automation with very little local staffing, maybe one or two local staff who were coming in once a week, and then everything else was pre-recorded programming. So they are trying to give some preference to people who are creating new programming that's local and that, you know, definitely have people on hand who are broadcasting live. So the FCC will look at those applications, they'll look at the point system and see who comes up with more points, and then award those licenses to people who have, you know, whatever party has the most points. When there are ties, then it gets even more complicated because then you can encourage people to enter into sharing agreements where, you know, one organization has the license half the time, the other organization has the license the other half of the time. Maybe it's days versus nights, maybe it's weekdays versus weekends. That gets really complicated. So once they get into the applications in the bigger towns and cities, that's where things will probably slow down a bit. And we don't know how long that will take. They were still clearing out applications from the 2000 window 8 and 9 years later.
Wow.
They have stated that they don't want that to happen again. We don't think it would take that long for them to get through licenses this time, to get through applications. But, you know, it's not something that is going to be, we submit our application in October and in January they say, hey, you got a license. You know, my guess is probably 2 years.
But then if it turns out that, you know, the chips fall where they may and Chirp gets a broadcast radio license, then you have a license for how long and what happens then?
Well, the nice thing about that is that we can get things up and running in a matter of weeks if we're awarded a broadcast license. We'll build a tower, and low-power FM towers aren't huge, giant towers on top of the Sears Tower. They're relatively small. We'll, get a transmitter. And we should be able to, my guess would be, on the outside, once we're awarded a broadcast license, we could probably get it set up 2 to 3 months. You have 18 months to build. When you are awarded a license, you get something called a construction permit. And so you have 18 months to get it up and running, and you can actually apply for extensions. Because we're in this situation where we actually have an operational radio station right now, we don't have to do any level of the build-out that other applicants would have to do. So it is a really quick process. And I have to admit to you on your other question, I cannot remember what the term of an LPFM is, the term of the license. Full-power stations?
I know for higher-power stations in Illinois, it's 8 years. That I do know.
Yeah, and that's federal. That's not state by state. I apologize. I can't remember what the term for an LPFM is. I believe it's different than full power.
Okay.
It's shorter.
Okay. Let's go back a little bit to one point you had raised with regards to the opposition against low power FM in the political fight over this. You had mentioned that the commercial broadcasters, like the National Association of Broadcasters and their allies, had opposed this, and it seemed like that there was understandable reason too. That was a competitor, and in a market, if you have a monopoly, you don't want a competitor because you might lose your position in that market. But NPR, where they're a nonprofit entity, you would figure wouldn't put up a fight, or you might think that, hey, this could be an opportunity to develop a supposed farm team of local broadcasters that could eventually go into the ranks of NPR. Elaborate, if you would, a bit about why NPR opposed something that you'd figure that they would be in favor of.
Well, their reasons weren't that different from the NAB's reasons. One big part of NPR's stated resistance to the bill was the fact that public radio stations tend to have a lot of translators. And, for instance, if you're, Wyoming Public Broadcasting, for instance, you're broadcasting out of Laramie. I'm just making up this example.
Sure,
I'm not sure where Wyoming Public Broadcasting is. Wyoming Public Broadcasting has translators all over the state because it's a hugely rural state, and it's providing a service to people who would have no way of hearing public radio, at least over the air, if they didn't have those translators. So NPR has been very defensive about the fact that they have all these translators. And to be honest, most of NPR's translators, they're using them for, I guess, what I would call for good purposes. I'm happy that rural Wyoming can have public radio that it wouldn't otherwise have. There was definitely sort of a knee-jerk reaction, like, well, low-power FM activists want translators, and we have lots of translators. So that was part of it. But I also think it's probably naive to believe that public radio isn't concerned about competition. Public radio has thrived a lot over the past, decade and a half, with the exception of the financial downturn where everybody hurt. And they've thrived in large part because they have been an alternative to commercial mainstream radio. They don't have commercials. They provide intelligent programming compared to, what you might hear on your top 40 station or even on your all-news station that, has 20 seconds per story. So public radio has done quite well for itself and, has really built up it into a big juggernaut, and they don't necessarily want their marketplace to hold to be challenged either. And community radio stations can offer something that a lot of public stations don't, which is local programming. Most public stations offer a lot of national programming and maybe only, one or two local shows a day, sometimes less than that. So that option of having a local station that actually is always live and local versus a lot of pre-recorded content coming from networks, whether public or commercial, is something that I think that NPR saw as a threat to their existing stations.
Even though we've been talking kind of like about broadcast radio, and I'm kind of like inspired by the example of Chirp, that even without broadcast licensing, you can use technologies like the web and like computers to be able to establish and build from the ground up a viable internet radio station. Is this an example that you think Chirp might want to encourage others to replicate elsewhere, even after this window closes in October?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a really good route to go. It's relatively cheap to start a station online. It doesn't have a high barrier to entry. If you have someone that you can recruit who has a reasonable level of tech savviness, they should be able to set you up. You don't need to have big fancy studios. You can have a basic microphone and a mixer and a computer, and you don't necessarily need a whole lot more than that. So I think that it's a really great opportunity both for hopefuls who would be interested in having a broadcast license one day to get started. What we realized was we had 100 people, and at the time that we were just beginning the organization, and after 5 or 6 months of just working on the LPFM issue, we said, well, why don't we just start a station now? We've got the person power, and we've got the knowledge, and we've got the enthusiasm from the community. But it's also just great even if you have no desire to ever apply for a broadcast license, because there are more and more ways for people to listen online, or to listen with apps, so they can be on the go. They don't have to be tethered to a computer at their desktop. And it's only going to get easier. The biggest barrier so far has been vehicles, because so much radio listening happens in cars. And, new cars are Wi-Fi enabled. There are all sorts of new options. You can plug in your iPod or your iPhone or Android phone into the dash with an adapter and listen that way. Hopefully you have an unlimited data plan if you're doing a lot of listening. But, cars are kind of the final frontier. It's the number one thing that we're asked about. But that's going to be changing. It's going to get easier. And so as time goes by, it's only going to get easier to listen online. So I definitely recommend anybody who has an interest in creating a station to create something online. And to remember that even if you're creating something online, that I think it's really important to be live as much as you can, and to have a sense of place. You don't have to be faceless and placeless when you're online. There's a lot of thought like, well, we want to appeal to an audience all over the world, so we shouldn't give any indication of where we are or, what this place is like. And I think that people in this era, when there is so much of that facelessness and placelessness, and that's such a cheesy thing to say, but it's kind of true, I think people really yearn for that a little bit. They want to have a sense of where you are, where you're talking to them from. They want to know who you are. It's that connection that radio has traditionally provided that is different from something like on a music side than Pandora or Spotify. It's people want to have that sense of connection to the person that they're listening to. And so don't be afraid to do something local, even if it's online. You don't have to make something that necessarily appeals to every single person in the world, and by doing that you make it completely generic. So you can be local online.
And the last question, actually going back for a moment to the LPFM window, for folks who might be affiliated with nonprofits for whom the idea could be an appealing one and who might have the resources to be able to pull it off, what should they do?
I would definitely recommend going to Prometheus Radio Project's website. PrometheusRadioProject.org. They've got great guidelines about how to get started, what you need to do, resources that you can reach out to them to talk to them. But that's really a great starting point. They've got everything you need there, and they've been at the forefront of this movement from the beginning. They do great work, and I highly recommend taking a look at their stuff.
That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indiemedia.org. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Dale Lehman for audio assistance. Thank you for listening, and please join us again for another episode from the Trenches.